Content warning. Discussions of violence, torture, animal cruelty, and death of both adults and children that some people may find disturbing.
Welcome to the Newcastle Witches podcast. Thank you for listening. This is episode 2, Magicians and Wizards and Witches. This episode is dedicated to Elizabeth Anderson.
Welcome back to the Newcastle Witches podcast. Today we are going to be talking about all things magical with Dr. Tabitha Stanmore, who is a postdoctoral research fellow at the University of Exeter, working with Professor Marion Gibson on the new Leverhulme Seven County Witch Trials project. Tabitha specialises in social and cultural reception of magic in England. Her first monograph, Love Spells and Love Treasure Service Magic in England from the Later Middle Ages, into the early modern era, will be published with Cambridge University Press in spring 2023.
Wow.
Do you know when you read something and it keeps going and I was like, oh, it's still the title?
Yeah, it's a really long title, I'm sorry.
No, it's fine. Hello, Tabitha.
Hello, thank you for having me.
Thank you for being here.
So on this podcast, we're going to discuss magic in the 17th century. If listeners are anything like me, they imagine witches having spells and putting things into a cauldron over a fire and they go poof, and then green smoke comes up and people turn into frogs. That is essentially my kind of idea of magic. Obviously, Caitlin has a very different idea of what it is, but we're here to find out.
Yes, I was lying in bed one night when I started the research on the Newcastle witch trials, and I just kind of, I think it was about 2 a.m, and I was like, but what kind of magic? Like, what was it they actually got, like, what was so bad about what they did that they were accused of this and were put to death? Like, what was so terrible about it? And I was like, I need to find someone who really, really knows about magic who can explain all of this to me. And I came across Tabitha's lecture on YouTube. You have a very good lecture there, don't you?
Oh, thank you. I've never watched it myself, actually, because I hate seeing my own face. But I'm glad you enjoyed it.
I did.
Yes. Hopefully I can tell you a bit about magic. It's definitely my wheelhouse anyway.
Yeah. So could we kind of get into, to start with, like, again, it was widely believed magic existed back then. Like, what did they believe magic was in the 17th century?
Yes, absolutely. So you're absolutely right. Magic was definitely believed in. There were lots of different types of magic that existed. It's easy to say that magic was believed in, but what we actually mean by that, you know, as your sort of 2 a.m. thought sort of struck you, it's not as simple as kind of anybody practicing magic was automatically seen as a witch, or anybody practicing magic was seen as evil or doing bad things. Because it was just, magic was just a part of everyday life. So we tend to refer to, or as historians, we would tend to refer to a magical universe, which is what pre-modern people basically inhabited. We're talking about a mentality where God exists, the devil exists, and those are just facts. The nature of God, or the way that you should worship God, is obviously up for debate, and the level of involvement that God had in sort of everyday life was also debated by people. But that didn't change the fact that, you know, these incredibly powerful supernatural beings existed, and that was just, you know, taken as read. Which obviously opens the door to more things as well. God could get involved in everyday happenings. Angels could be sent to sort of intervene in people's lives. The devil loved to play tricks on people. And generally there was, you know, an opportunity for supernatural beings to meddle in people's lives. And as part of that, people could also meddle back potentially, or harness these sort of supernatural powers to make a difference in their own lives. So that's not to say that people were particularly gullible. People were no more gullible then than they are today, but they have a sort of broader worldview of what is possible. And beyond what we kind of know is possible now, they also had an extra layer on top of their sort of realms of possibility that included all sorts of supernatural stuff.
Interjecting, because when you were talking there, I was like, oh, I wonder if they believed in angels, which you said that they did. But did they Was this sort of idea of magic, was that at all connected to certainly in like the Catholic religion of specific items of clothing were from saints or saintly beings? Like, was it from, you know, relics of the cross had special powers, if you held them, you would be healed? Is that connected to magic? Was it seen as separate from the church, or was it all sort of muddled, like intertwined?
Excellent question, and it very much depends who you asked in the 17th century especially. Obviously, by the 17th century, England has undergone a couple of reformations. It's officially split from the Catholic Church twice by this point, once under Henry VIII and another time under Elizabeth I. And those kinds of things that you're referring to, you know, relics and the sort of the power of saints' clothing or the power of saints, you know, even praying to saints, is by the 17th century very much seen as a kind of bad magic or even witchcraft by Protestants. Obviously, if you ask a Catholic, these kinds of practices are completely fine, you know, sort of using a bit of a saint's blood, for example, you know, putting that into some water and drinking that water, perfectly legitimate sort of healing charm, which, you know, would have been completely condoned by 16th, 17th century Catholic Church, but, you know, for some people would be very, very unorthodox, depending on your sort of confession, I guess. So, yeah, what magic is and what counts as magic definitely varies according to who you are in the early modern period. That said, we can definitely say that that's still supernatural, even if it's not magic, because it is definitely sort of transcending the bounds of what nature can normally achieve.
Okay, so, I mean, if you were from a sort of Catholic heritage, essentially, you could be in hot water quite easily if, you know, things that you believed were suddenly like, well, here's this Protestant who's now in charge of everything. Could that get you in trouble, essentially?
Yeah, absolutely could. It could be a form of heresy. It could also be seen as superstition, which was a sort of separate category of things in the medieval and early modern periods, where it's basically you're practicing bad religion. So it depends kind of the motivation behind how you're doing these things. So it could be that you're just misinformed, basically. The country has switched over to Protestantism, your new priest is Protestant, and you're still continuing these Catholic practices. If you don't know any better, then normally it'll just be a case of sort of re-educating you to sort of, you know, tell you how is the right way to worship. But if you sort of continued in those practices, or you even use some of these old Catholic practices to try to do harm especially, then yeah, that would definitely get you into hot water.
Oh dear.
Oh no. That makes sense, the kind of connection between religion and magic in that regard, and how when the country changed religion, that they kind of like, no, that's wrong now. You have to practice this way to do it now, and everything you believed before is now wrong. But obviously there will be people passing these things down to their families anyway, so you can kind of see why there was confusion at the time.
Yeah, exactly. And also bear in mind that people were resisting conversion as well. I mean, religion is an incredibly personal thing, and you know, there's a lot at stake in terms of how you worship and who you worship. Well, sorry, who you worship. You should always be worshiping God, obviously, but the way that you do that, it could be the difference between you getting into heaven or being sent to hell, for example. So people really cared about getting it right, and a lot of people obviously didn't think that the Protestants had got it right. So especially in the northwest of England, Catholicism continues to be sort of the dominant practice, even though it's legal, well into the 17th century. And there's quite a few sort of movements to try to rout that out. And there's a lot of either, you know, very, very heavy fines on sort of well-known Catholic families, and occasionally executions as well to try to get rid of this practice. But it's very stubborn.
Yeah, so we know, we've kind of gone through briefly kind of the connection between religion and magic, but they kind of believed there was magic in their everyday lives as well, didn't they? Like, it was widely believed that they could find lost items and stuff, couldn't they?
Yes, yeah. So this is my specialist area, and what I research the most is that kind of that practical magic that you're talking about. So that's finding lost goods, casting love spells, doing a lot of healing magic, finding buried treasure, very popular during the early modern period.
Tell me more. I want to find this treasure. Where is it?
How much like buried treasure did they think was hiding about that you would need magic to find it?
Well, I mean, if you think about it, it's probably actually quite a lot. I don't know whether, you know, what, how often you check the news about buried treasure that's been found. But I think every sort of year or so, there's always like, you know, kind of big news story about, you know, discoveries of like the Staffordshire hoard and other different hoards of, you know, coins that are found by metal detectorists today. And it's kind of like the early modern version of metal detecting. There's a lot of people who have buried, you know, silver, gold, precious jewels, that kind of thing, underground for safekeeping over the last several thousand years. Sometimes you might find it. But it gets easier to do if you can get some magic involved, because spirits, who mostly live underground a lot of the time, will be able to tell you where the treasure is, because they've seen it basically with their own eyes. So you can summon these spirits and ask them. And if the spirits behave themselves, or if you ask them nicely enough, then they might tell you where to go and dig. So spiritual metal detecting is a thing.
And that was popular. That was something people did a lot of.
Fairly popular. It actually seems to be quite an upper class activity, because summoning spirits, which may be unexpected, but summoning spirits is quite a complex procedure. And if you actually want to control them to make them do what you want, as opposed to sort of run rampage and sort of run rings around you, then you need to know the proper rituals to perform. And that means essentially performing an exorcism, so sort of summoning the power of Christ or the power of God, and getting that sort of superior power to control the demons that you're asking questions to. And that means having quite a good education. It means normally having either a sort of priestly background, or being able to at least read Latin to a standard where you're able to recite these exorcistic rituals. Exorcistic, is that a word? Exorcism rituals.
It's a word now.
It definitely can be one. It could be one for now anyway. Yes, you have to have a relatively high education to be able to perform these kinds of things. And that means that either you're going to be employing somebody who has these skills so that they can sort of perform these conjurations on your behalf, which means you have to have a decent amount of money, or you have to have those skills yourself, which again probably means that you are at at least middle class level. So in that sense, it's probably not as common as other kinds of practical magic, this sort of treasure hunting, but it's still something which is common enough to be legislated against and to be seen as a problem by the church and anybody else who thinks that maybe summoning demons is not the best idea.
It sounds like something that the rich and bored would do. They're like, hang on, you know what? Let's go find some buried treasure, but let's summon like these spirits and like these spirits to help us do it, but then, oh no, we've got to be able to control the spirits. It just sounds like really overly complicated that the kind of your average working person wouldn't have the time to kind of put the energy into.
Yeah, very true. And also, I mean, I think I'd add sort of rich, bored, and unable to budget. A lot of the cases we have with this are people who have just, you know, sort of gambled away a lot of their money, or just overspend like way beyond their income, find themselves in a hole and think, how am I going to get out of this? I better go and dig for some treasure and see what I can find.
Yeah, what spells did they, you know, first of all, who would be qualified to cast a spell, and what kind of spells were they casting?
So yes, love spells were pretty common, and they are much more widespread. That there isn't a kind of class divide with that kind of thing. Everybody needs help sometimes finding the ideal partner, or being able to get married, or being able to get out of their relationship as well. There are spells to help people fall in love. There are spells to help people fall out of love so they can fall in love with the right person instead, as well as kind of divination in terms of, you know, who you might marry, so that kind of thing. And there were a range of different people you could go to about this. People who practiced love magic or other kinds of healing magic especially, which was again very, very common. There's no division between sort of gender in this. We've got male and female cunning folk, is what we tend to call them, these people who are sort of selling practical magic. And they could be any class, they could be any age. There's no real pattern there. What there does tend to be is a particular skill, essentially. It might be that they have a particular knowledge about how to perform one spell, and then their name gets out about that. So it could be that they know one particular formula, say, so a kind of a short part of a Latin prayer or something like that, or they know how to perform one particular ritual, and they will just use that for anybody who asks them. So this can be on a very, very local level. It could be your neighbour who knows this stuff, and they're just sort of called on an ad hoc basis. Or it could be people who gained a reputation for themselves or kind of had a little bit more knowledge, and they would sort of sell that kind of on a wider scale and potentially even make an income out of it. So it's very, very varied. And it seems to be that mostly these kinds of things are meeting a demand. So the supply tends to sort of match what kinds of people, you know, what kinds of priorities that people had.
I guess I'd be interested to know, just because my own life experience says you can't actually say a prayer or cast a spell and make somebody fall in love with you. So there must have been varying kind of success rates. And sort of what happened if you unfortunately took money to cast a spell so that man A could, you know, the woman of his desire would fall in love with him, but you weren't successful. She actually decided to marry another man. Like, did they experience retaliation? Is that sort of what might have convinced them to be accused of being witches and sort of have that sort of revenge element to it? Is that what could get them in trouble in any way? Or did people just go, oh, well, spells don't always work?
A combination of both. So it's worth saying now, actually, that, you know, I've sort of mentioned the word cunning folk, and by that I do mean these people who are sort of selling practical spells to kind of all and sundry, whoever needs them. There were a lot of those people across England. Can't give you specific numbers because we don't even know the real population size of England at the time. And a lot of these people would have just sort of fallen under the radar and never been mentioned, so it's very hard to say. But we are talking about probably hundreds at least of cunning folk who are practicing at any one time. The vast majority of those would not be prosecuted as witches. They wouldn't be accused of being witches. And I'll come on to sort of what a witch is in a minute. So there was definitely fear around what these people could potentially do, and there was definitely resentment sometimes building up if the magic failed, which, as you say, it definitely did on a regular basis. But whether that was treated as enough to kind of accuse somebody of being a witch, that's debatable. What we do definitely have records of is people asking for their money back if it doesn't work. Or going back to the cunning person and saying, it didn't work, what did I do wrong? And then they'll try a different spell, essentially, and kind of keep going until something works. But also there is this acceptance that sometimes God just intervenes, or life just intervenes, or, you know, maybe the cunning person's just a bit crap.
Yeah, I was going to say, so they did, it wasn't a case of, I think people are a lot more skeptical now. If you said you were going to cast like a love spell on someone and it didn't work, they'd go, well, that's because it's not real. But back then it was very much like they were just bad at magic. Or maybe God intervened somehow because it wasn't the course I was set on. So they were like more eager to try it again.
Yeah, exactly. And if somebody does have a reputation of normally being very successful at these things, then, you know, maybe it is really that it just really wasn't meant to be. Or maybe you haven't paid the cunning man enough. There's lots of different reasons.
Oh, so maybe they just didn't cast it well enough because you were a cheapskate.
It's possible. You know, I mean, we've all sort of not put in 100% in one of our jobs, right? So
I have no idea what that means.
Okay. What is there an idea of what a cunning folk person looked like or how they lived in contrast to, and like, what would make them a witch or distinguish them from a witch?
Because there is a stereotype, but I say a stereotype, it's like a misconception that a lot of cunning folk or like cunning women were accused of witchcraft, but that wasn't quite right, was it?
Yes. Yeah, exactly. So it's a really interesting question, actually, like what did a cunning person look like? Because we don't know. There's basically no images from the early modern period of cunning folk.
Oh.
Yeah. You get a lot of pictures of witches, obviously, which do sort of embody the entire stereotype that you have in your mind right now, sort of warty, old, poor, hunchback, you know, very long nose often. That image was definitely circulating and it was used to sort of, you know, stereotype what witches were. We do have some descriptions of cunning folk, but those are normally from quite negative sources. So people who are essentially trying to sort of warn the population away from using cunning folk, and they will often describe them as being charlatans and rogues. Male cunning folk are often described as being dressed up as if they are doctors, so, you know, physicians, or dressed up as university students or something like that to kind of make themselves look impressive. University students used to wear the sort of the big long black billowing robes that you kind of still see on Oxford students today, and in big sort of velvet doctoral caps. So, you know, they might wear that kind of thing to make themselves look impressive, but actually they're charlatans. So that's one image that you get of cunning folk. The female image is closer to that sort of witch stereotype. It's normally a daft old woman who can't be trusted, is quite, you know, gibbers a lot, and is sort of, is somebody who only a fool would go to. But again, that is a stereotype which is created often in church sermons or in plays and that kind of thing to put people off of visiting these people. And it's not actually an accurate depiction at all. When it comes to the difference between cunning folk and witches, there was definitely a clear distinction in most people's minds about what a cunning person does versus what a witch does. Occasionally you hear cunning folk being referred to as white witches. So there is sometimes that overlap in terms of language, I guess. But most of the time when somebody's referring to a witch, they are talking about somebody who is spiteful and is aiming to do harm, and normally aiming to do harm through the help of the devil. They've got a familiar spirit or several different familiar spirits that turn up in all sorts of different shapes and sizes. They can be anything from a cat to a toad to a rat to a chicken to a rock in some cases. And they use these sort of demons in different forms to go and do harm to their neighbours. And you wouldn't expect a cunning person to do that, basically. You know, that they're there to help. Often cunning folk would say that they are working through God. They would say they're working through fairies. They would say, I don't know how it works, but it works, and I've only ever intended to do good. Witches are evil. People are scared of witches because they have, you know, completely sold themselves to the devil and are committed just to hurting people.
And of course, if you are living at a time when you believe that there are fairies and angels and good spirits, you then have to consider that there's the opposite of that. And that's how people were very convinced that the devil did appear and there were covens of witches, is essentially what we can say from that.
Yeah, yeah, exactly, exactly. Yeah, if you've got all these good spirits going around, of course there are bad spirits. I mean, you know, Satan fell from heaven and has been doing terrible things ever since. He's got lots and lots of demons running around. Of course, some people are going to be tempted to use them.
So the kind of witch magic, what was it? Like, there was like some kind of demonic intervention there somehow. But like, what was it they could do that was like so feared?
Oh, many things. Many, many things. So it could start off small. It could be things like making it rain inconveniently. Somebody could fall over.
Sorry, it's just England and it rains inconveniently all the time.
Witches everywhere.
Sorry, continue.
But mostly what they're scared, you know, what they're feared for doing is everything from raising really nasty storms that destroy crops to stopping cows from being able to produce milk, outright killing the cow, all the way up to killing people. By the 17th century, the idea of possession has also sort of arrived in England very, very strongly. So the idea that witches could send one of their familiar spirits to possess somebody and torment them was very, very common. So sort of people would fall into fits, they'd start seeing sort of visions, normally visions of the devil or the witch themselves coming and tormenting these people. But they could also do sort of physical things to people. So there's a pamphlet called The Witches of Northamptonshire, which was published in 1612. And it describes various different witches in Northamptonshire who were sort of accused and tried and eventually executed in most cases for their activities. And that describes one male witch, actually, called Arthur Bill, who was accused of killing Martha Aspin to death, killing her to death. Sorry, I've been reading the pamphlet and that's actually what it says.
I think with the intent to kill, you usually tend to get them a bit dead.
So. Yeah, normally, yeah. But bewitching them to death, which would normally involve, as I say, sort of fits or kind of a wasting sickness or something like that, which, you know, lasts a long time. And then eventually sort of, you know, they die. But yeah, Arthur Bill, he was accused of doing this to Martha Aspin. He was swum, i.e. thrown into a pond with his feet and his hands tied together to see whether he would float. He did float, so it was confirmed that he was a witch. But he refused to confess. His mother and his father were also arrested at the same time, and they were also floated, and they both floated. So they were taken to prison as well. And according to this pamphlet that we have, which is brought together from a range of different sources and is kind of published for sort of popular entertainment, information, etc. Yeah, this pamphlet says that Arthur and his mother were terrified that their father would confess against them. So in prison, Arthur and his mother get together and they bewitch a large ball into the father's throat so that he physically can't speak. And the interrogators find this ball and they pull it out of his throat. So it's literally sort of been put there by these kind of devilish machinations. And you've got examples of that kind of thing happening all over the place. You see examples of witches thought of as sort of putting pins into people's stomachs so that people actually start vomiting pins or bits of straw.
Oh.
And this is the kind of thing that's going around. And, you know, people, very eminent people are saying that they've seen this happen. And people are reading about this and going, oh no, this is the kinds of things that witches are capable of. So, and you can imagine, I mean, vomiting pins must be a horrific experience. So yeah, that's the kinds of things that witches can do.
Our witches in Newcastle, they were alive at a time when life was very hard. I imagine, like what you're saying about how witches do bad things, it might be an easy sort of bridge to cross to go from we are starving and hungry to somebody must be causing the devil to do this, not just personally but also like a whole city.
Yes, it is possible to make that bridge, and the idea that the devil was getting involved in this kind of thing is certainly something that people were sort of thinking and acting on. We do need to be quite careful with that bridge, though, essentially because, you know, there's always been epidemics. There were many, many bouts of plague and cholera and all sorts of other things. And people were aware that this was part of the natural course of things as well. Famines do sometimes happen. Sometimes it could be a godly punishment. Sometimes it could be the devil messing around. Sometimes it could be caused by witches, but it could also be just what life does. So normally we're looking for something which pushes this over the edge from just bad luck or just life happening to the witches being involved. Because it's not, if witches were always the explanation, then we would see a lot more witch trials than we actually do.
It's useful to know that it might have been like kind of a build-up of these events, but also that just because bad things were happening, they didn't immediately blame witches. It was, or like they didn't immediately blame kind of divine intervention somehow. That they did think, okay, this is a natural thing that can just happen sometimes, and it might not be anyone's fault.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly.
So there is a tipping point here where things started to get quite bad, and then it circles around to being a case of this is dark magic and dark forces at work here. Okay. Well, I guess that's what we're trying to figure out. Yeah. What was that tipping point?
Yeah, because something that I'm interested in as well, which kind of links, it all kind of links in together, is that there was, like you said before, of the treasure hunting, that was kind of done by the upper class. There was different, like, kind of levels of magic in different people who could do magic, and some of it was, like, more highly regarded and for, like, a higher social class than kind of people if you go lower down the scale, wasn't there?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. There definitely was. There is often this kind of idea that it was a class divide, that, you know, sort of poorer people and, you know, less educated people were the ones who believed in magic, and then we sort of have this kind of enlightenment sort of level at the top where, you know, people just don't believe in that kind of thing. Absolutely not true. Everybody's believing in this stuff. Everybody's partaking in magic in some form or another. I say everybody, that's probably a bit of a stretch, but every social class is taking part in magic in some way. Yeah, so we have records, for example, of aristocratic women buying love spells. I don't know whether either of you have come across the case of Thomas Overbury, who was one of the confidants of James I's best friend. So Robert Carr, who was James I's favourite before the Duke of Buckingham, George Villiers became James I's favourite, he was very well regarded. James lavished all sorts of different titles on him, lots of money, all sorts of wonderful things. And Robert started getting too big for his boots in many ways. He started having a very open affair with a woman called Frances, who was already married. I know, awkward. She hated her husband, so decided the best thing to do would be to claim that he was impotent and then divorce him and then marry Robert instead. All fine and hunky-dory, except that Thomas Overbury, who was Robert Carr's best friend, strongly disapproved of this match. Thomas Overbury ends up being arrested on sort of trumped-up political charges, and then ends up dying in prison in very mysterious circumstances.
Oh, no.
This is successfully ignored for about 2 years because Robert is James's favourite.
Yep.
And James does not want to hear about it. James does not want to get involved. Unfortunately, the general populace of London especially is not having any of this and really wants to find out what happened to Thomas Overbury. So they sort of kick up a massive fuss, and eventually this whole thing is investigated. It turns out that probably Francis was employing somebody to try to kill Thomas either by poison or by magic,
mm-hmm.
and that she had spent a lot of money on love spells to both get Robert to be interested in her in the first place and also to try to get rid of her former husband.
Right.
This could be seen as a political thing which was sort of directed against the woman, and there was definitely a lot of misogyny involved in this case as well. But I genuinely believe that she was buying love spells, at least, and I do think that both Robert and she were involved in trying to kill Thomas because it was just getting too awkward to have him around anymore. We know that there was a cunning woman involved in selling the love spells to Francis. She confessed to everything, and this wasn't done under torture. She just, you know, confessed to it. Her name was Mary Woods. And this cunning woman, Mary Woods, had been selling love spells to probably quite a few other women at the royal court for quite a long time beforehand. So this is all a very long way of saying that cunning women were definitely running in and out of aristocratic circles. The aristocracy were definitely buying this kind of magic, as well as things like divination as well. So kind of employing astrologers to find out what was going to be happening in people's futures, or potentially even predicting the fate of the king. And astrologers actually during the Civil War of the 1640s were employed on both sides, both the parliamentarian and the royalist sides, to find out sort of which battles were going to be successful, which side God was on, whether it was, you know, the parliamentarian side or the royalist side, just kind of what would happen next. So yeah, this definitely isn't a sort of lower class thing. This is for everybody.
So there was like cunning men and women running around. There was astrologers, witches, obviously, even though they were kind of the more demonic, as we say, magic. Were there any other kinds of people just out of interest who were like mages and magicians and all this sort of thing? So just were those kinds of like roles running around back then as well?
Yes, yeah. So there was also ritual magicians, just to throw those into the mix as well. They are the kind of the typical magus, mage kind of image. So if you've ever heard of John Dee, who was a sort of very well-respected, well, very knowledgeable at least, astrologer during Elizabeth I's reign and the beginning of James I's reign as well. He was incredibly intelligent. He was a mathematician. He was an astronomer. He did a lot of work on navigation as well, and helped sort of work out how to get to get across the Atlantic and how to navigate across the Atlantic. But he was also very, very interested in magic. He spent a lot of his time summoning angels and asking them various different questions about how to, you know, make wonderful things happen, as well as to kind of access secrets of the universe. So you've got them as well, and again they could perform the kind of mundane tasks as well. So, you know, he divined what Elizabeth's reign was going to be like through his astrology and later through sort of angelic magic as well. But he, you know, his ilk at least could also be asked to, I don't know, look into healing as well if needed. So yeah, it's the kinds of uses to which magic were put were relatively narrow. It was normally towards the same ends, but how you went about it, I guess, is what differentiates cunning folk from ritual magicians from astrologers.
So I guess that leads me back to my original statement of like how I was taught that a witch is it putting potions and things. But you're saying a lot of it came from prayers or cantations or whatever. Is this sort of something that applied to the cunning folk and the more the witches, the dark magic, as it were? Or, you know, where did the cauldron come from? I want to know.
I think nowadays you'd use a microwave, wouldn't you? You wouldn't use a cauldron.
I don't know. I'm just interested to know, like, if they were actually making potions of any kind, or if it was very much like the evil eye or saying, a spell. You know, is that really what it was?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question, actually. So the cauldron definitely does come up in various different formats. So I think, you know, the most famous version, most famous example would be Macbeth. Obviously, round and round the cauldron go.
Yeah.
You know, something about entrails throwing. that
eye of newt and toe of frog, like they were putting things together.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. So you do get that image coming up. I feel like that sort of image is a bit hammy. It definitely was at the time as well. Because, yeah, a lot more of it probably would have been incantations and that kind of thing. And it's worth bearing in mind that a lot of these things were being conducted in a Christian universe. You know, that most people are sort of starting from a Christian background here and starting from Christian ideas. So, you know, whether you're using a prayer to heal or you're kind of doing the reverse and you're, you know, cursing somebody through some kind of, you know, whatever it is, spoken words, whatever, you're still doing it within a Christian context. For example, the witches that James I claimed to have seen as he was going in his ship back from Denmark to Scotland, he saw them going around his ship in a sieve for some reason. They'd raised storms and then, you know, everybody was worried that the ship was going to sink. James looked out over the deck and he sees these witches sitting in a sieve going around his ship.
Sorry. So,
you know, it's mildly ridiculous. I'm pretty sure it was a sieve just because that would be so impossible. So it's really showing that there is like a kind of defying nature. But the way that they were able to do that and the way that they were able to raise the storm in the first place was apparently by taking a cat, baptizing it, putting it into a bag and then throwing it into the sea. So bad times for the cat, obviously.
Oh.
But But more than that, it's that subversion of Christian ritual. It's taking something, it's desecrating a Christian ritual, and then it's putting that desecration into the sea, which is causing the water to boil and for the storm to be raised. A lot of this action is very much Christian founded a lot of the time. Going back to the cauldron thing, I genuinely don't know. Cauldrons were obviously very common back then, just as a cooking implement. So it could also be something about that uncanniness of something which is meant to be a comforting, usable item that you'd have in your house that provides food, that is, you know, something which is warm and you associate with your home, being used for something which is actually terrifying. So it could have been Shakespeare's attempt to make something which was deeply uncanny by putting this cauldron in a new context, which obviously then gets picked up on by later writers.
So it is quite possible that if Shakespeare was around today writing these things, it could have been a microwave.
Yeah, basically, yeah.
I have a theory and I'm sticking to it.
This is all incredibly interesting, especially what you said about how it was sort of subverting with the Christian, the good, holy acts that were meant to bring you blessings and doing sort of the opposite to bring harm. I think I'm starting to understand sort of why a witch was accused of doing certain things and how they would have had to have done these things to summon black magic. That's been really interesting.
I'm thinking about the cats again. Every time I read about, obviously, the witch trials and these horrible things that they did to these poor people they accused of witches, every time someone mentions a cat, I just feel myself curl up. I'm like, something horrible happened to this cat. I've heard quite a few different stories of just like cats being buried or cats being killed or cats being burned just for being a cat.
It's horrible. It's brutal. I don't know if this is any comfort, but it wasn't just cats.
Yeah, it wasn't just cats.
Yeah. I think it's quite interesting, actually, because in some ways it shows just how much agency people thought that animals had in the early modern period. So there are examples of pigs being hanged, for example, and being put on trial as well for the way that they behaved. I think it's a 17th century example of a pig gets into a house, and it's got nothing to do with witchcraft, but I think it's an interesting example of what animals were getting up to. A pig broke into somebody's house and, trigger alert, ate a baby, because pigs eat anything.
Yeah. Oh, that's horrible.
Yeah, and obviously, you know, the parents are distraught. This is a terrible thing, but the pig is actually blamed for it as if it was a human. So it was dressed up in clothes, it was put on trial, it was found guilty, and it was hanged. So, you know, we're really seeing that, you know, animals are seen as having an active part in everyday life. They're not just sort of, you know, beasts that don't know any better. They're sort of almost treated on the same level as humans sometimes.
I didn't know that about the animals, but it does explain where the kind of the familiar image comes from and why the familiars were kind of so intelligent, I guess, or how like maybe an intelligent animal might be like accused of something alongside of a woman who was accused of witchcraft. I can understand that a bit more now. I didn't know that, so.
Yeah, and it does make sense why, the animals were punished and the familiars were punished. Exactly. As well as the fact, you know, familiars aren't meant to be demons in animal form, so, you know, get rid of those if you possibly can, I think is the general idea behind it.
Yeah, it sounds like as well that the kind of modern image we have of a witch seems to be something of a mix between what they believed was a witch in the 17th century, but also like what a cunning woman was. It sounds like the kind of idea of all these different kinds of magic, like with the magicians and the astrologers, is all being mixed together. And that's what people believe a modern day witch is. You know, they believe they can cast spells. They kind of go for the Harry Potter vibe. So you can see kind of over the years how it's kind of all been merged together to create a modern day version of a witch. But it's actually very different to what a witch was in the 17th century, which was kind of the opposite of all that was good. It was everything that was bad.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. That's a lovely way of putting it. Absolutely.
Wow. On that note, I feel like we could just talk for like a couple more hours. This has been really fascinating to learn more about what magic meant to people in the 1600s.
Because it was so key in their lives. Like it was like kind of as prominent as magic in a way, as religion in a way, wasn't it? It was kind of just about, it existed.
Yeah, exactly.
Thank you so much.
Yes, thank you so much for
Dr. Tabitha Stanmore. Thank you for joining us. And obviously, we need to find this tipping point and do more investigating.
Yes, we do.
Into things. Really enjoyed speaking to you. Thank you so much.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
Thank you for listening to the Newcastle Witches podcast. I'm Maria.
And I'm Caitlin.
If you want to find out more about what we spoke about in this episode and past or future episodes, you can find us on social media, Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter by searching for the Newcastle Witches podcast. And there's also a dedicated page linking and profiling the many guests we have on the podcast. It's candleandbell.com/Newcastle Witches.
Please feel free to ask us any questions, or if there's anything you want to know more about, then just find us on our socials and we'll reply to you there.
Thank you for listening, and I hope you'll join us for the next episode of the Newcastle Witches podcast.